Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
This evening, to the Poetry Center of Chicago's poetry reading featuring Charles Simic. I'm Kenneth Clark. I'm the Executive Director of the Poetry Center of Chicago. Now in our 26th year, the Poetry Center is proud to continue a tradition of showcasing the best poets and writers of our time right here in downtown Chicago. In addition to our nationally esteemed reading series, we sponsor a Poets in Residence program at 11 Chicago schools. We do this with the knowledge that teaching children to read and write poetry will make them more literate and able to navigate a world that demands creative communication. Special gratitude goes out to our many supporters and sponsors who help make these programs possible. On the back of tonight's program, if you didn't get one, they're on the back table, you will see our special members and also our sponsors. Through their support, the Poetry Center continues to thrive. I want to also thank the many volunteers we had for this evening's event. Volunteers, raise your hands. Volunteers, thank you very much for helping us with the crowd. And I also want to thank my wonderful board of directors. I would like my board of directors, any of you who are here, to please stand so that everybody can see who you are and then come up to you and talk to you afterwards. Board members, Enid. I know there's more. There's Debbie back there. There's John. The Poetry Center is in residence at the School of the Art Institute. We receive in-kind support from the school and also moral support for our programs from them. Major sponsorship programming comes from the Lannan Foundation, also the Fred and Susan Novy Family Foundation, the Chicago Department for Cultural Affairs, and the Illinois Arts Council Estate Agency. If you're not a member of the Poetry Center, please consider joining. We could use your help, as well as there are some valuable memberships, such as free access to all the readings for a year. Couple last things here. The Poetry Center is also supported by Prairie Restaurant. If you filled out a survey, you got a 25% off discount. They are also housing our poets this year at a very low rate, right down in the loop. It's very convenient, so they have good food. The Chicago Area Great Books Council is going to have a discussion of one of Charles Simic's poems immediately following the reading over in the corner over near the bar. It'll be conveniently located near the bar. You can get a drink. Lorna Anderson, could you wave your hand? If you'd like to take part in this discussion, please see her after the event. And it is now my pleasure to introduce John Rezik, president of the Poetry Center Board of Directors. And he's going to share with you some information about a very important person in the Poetry Center's history, Martha Friedberg. John?
Thank you, and thank you all for coming. The member of our board who is to talk about Martha Friedberg is not here, and I'm not going to do as good a job as Mark Proberg would have done. However, I was one of the founding board members of the center back in 1974, and I remember Martha quite well. She's a wonderful lady, gracious lady, a poet, and someone who, without whom this Poetry Center would not have survived. At every moment of its, at every crisis moment of its history, Martha was there to lend her support, lend her advice, and to give us the sustenance that we needed to go on. This reading, particular reading, is named after her. We have one every year dedicated to a distinguished poet who we think Martha would have admired and whose work is of great significance. Now I will talk about Charles Simic. In starting a review of Charles Simic's latest book of poems, Jackstraws, a writer quotes the poet's response to the question, "To whom do you show a poem before you submit it?" Simic answers, I show it to Wallace Stevens and Emily Dickinson. If I catch them making faces, I hop back under the blankets and scribble some more. It is perhaps because of the rigor of this discipline that another reviewer of the same book concluded, Simic is a master at interrogating ordinary occurrences with piercing yet slightly tongue-in-cheek observations. Another critic points out, Simic shows that he is among the very few poets for whom surrealism is a genuine vision, a tool of discovery, rather than a collection of arbitrary shocks. The reviewer concludes that Simic's skill and sure instinct make his one of the most important poetic achievements of our time. Charles Simic was born in Yugoslavia in 1938 and emigrated to the United States in 1954. In one of his memoirs, he tells of coming to Chicago in 1955, living in Oak Park, graduating from high school, and working for the Chicago Sun-Times as a proofreader. At night, he went to the Newberry Library to read the French surrealists and literary magazines. He wrote, "One moment, so it seemed, I was an unremarkable Yugoslav schoolboy, and the next moment I was in Chicago writing poetry in English as if it were the most normal thing to do." It turns out it may well have been the most normal thing for him to do. Simic has published more than 14 books of poems and 4 books of essays and memoirs and several books of translations. His 1990 collection, The World Doesn't End, Prose Poems, won the Pulitzer Prize. His other awards include a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, a Guggenheim Foundation Scholarship, the Penn Translation Award. He is currently professor of English at the University of New Hampshire. Among the many pleasures of one of his works, Wonderful Words, Silent Truth, are these thoughts picked more or less at random. Poetry is a way of knowledge, but most poetry tells us what we already know. It is the object I'm watching, the fork, for example, which sets up the rules of its visibility. Momentary deities is, I believe, how the Greeks thought of words. I admire Claude Levi Strauss's observation that all art is essentially reduction, and Gertrude Stein saying that poetry is vocabulary. Everything was right with the world until that yokel, Rambo, opened his mouth. Everyone wants to be able to paraphrase the content of a poem, except the poet. Charles Simic's poems, like these observations of his, are spare, irreverent, unadorned, and challenging. The Poetry Center is delighted to have this distinguished poet with us tonight.
I must say, it's always wonderful to hear these things because I completely forgotten I ever wrote them. Who would go back and reread epigrams, you know, supposedly that you wrote 20 years ago? Great pleasure to be in Chicago. Chicago is a place where I only spent a few years, but I sort of moved from being an adolescent to, I guess, a semi-adolescent. I mean, I left home when I was 18, so that was a terrific thing, made life exciting. I wrote a lot of bad poems in Chicago, probably more bad poems than I wrote in other cities. I mean, there were a lot of bad poems in New York, but I can think of hundreds and hundreds of, seemed like good ideas at the time. So I thought I would begin with a poem that has a number of versions, early versions, but was written in Chicago. I mean, what happened was that this version, which is actually better than some of the versions that I published in my very first book, I had suppressed or for some reason. You know, you're not too smart, you know, even when you get old. You can't distinguish clearly between, you know, various versions. The poem is called Cockroach. When I see a cockroach, I don't grow violent like you. I stop as if a friendly greeting had passed between us. This roach is familiar to me. We met here and there in the kitchen at midnight, and now on my pillow. I can see it has a couple of my black hairs sticking out of its head, and who knows what else. It carries false papers. Don't ask me how I know. False papers, yes, with my greasy thumbprint. Well, I left Chicago in 1958, so this is not very, you know, we're going back really in time. Today, as I was walking just in this over here, Michigan Avenue, I remembered how, when was this? Must be 1956. There was a convention, right? Democrats, presidential convention. Just about here, I saw ex-President Truman walking. And I saw a couple of people go up to him and shake his hand. It was early in the morning. I don't know what the hell I was doing here. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning. And so I walked up to President Truman, and I shook my hand. She shook my hand. And totally meaningless story. Okay. It's a limp microphone. All right, let's see. I'm going to read first from this sort of early poem, selected early poems. And this is now in a different place, New England, but early 70s. A poem called A Partial Explanation. A poem about a mill town in New England. There were many mill towns in New England, and in very early 70s, late 60s, they all were kind of... They closed up. I mean, businesses went bankrupt or they moved away, and they were sad-looking places. And so this is from this period. The partial explanation. Seems like a long time since the waiter took my order. Grimy little luncheonette, the snow falling outside. Seems like it has grown darker since I last heard the kitchen door behind my back. Since I last noticed anyone pass on the street. A glass of ice water keeps me company at this table I chose myself upon entering. And a longing, incredible longing, to eavesdrop on the conversation of cooks. It's a poem called The Writings of the Mystics. There used to be a bookstore dedicated to the occult in New York on 4th Avenue called Weiser's. And, they had a basement. I remember you go down in the basement and, you know, lights were usually not on. You had to kind of turn them on, big strings from a light bulb, naked bulb. And you would... turn the lights on, and it would say something like, you know, you see the first sign, like the Egyptian Book of the Dead, or the, you know, Tibetan Secrets, How to Become Invisible, you know, and 39 cents. this is kind of an homage to those days of, you know, when I was a frequent customer at Weiser's, called The Writings of the Mystics. On the counter among many much-used books, the rare one you must own immediately, the one that makes your heart race as you wait for small change with a silly grin you'll take to the street and later pass the landlady watching you wipe your shoes. Then up to the rented room which neighbors the one of a nightclub waitress who is shaving her legs with the door partly open, while you turn to the first page, which speaks of a presentiment of a higher existence in things familiar and drab, in a house soon to be torn down, suddenly hushed and otherworldly, you have to whisper your own name and the words of the hermit, since it must be long past dinner, the one they ate quickly, happy that your small portion went to the three-legged dog. there was a kind of place where you had a feeling if you just read this book, you would understand everything. You know, you would sort of, you know, on the completion of the book, you would begin to glow and levitate and, you know, come out in the street. However, you know, didn't happen. Well, a little maybe, you know. Okay, this is another poem from late 60s, early 70s. There was a kind of an epidemic, or maybe epidemic is not the right word for it, rash of attacks on sort of masterpieces in museums by disgruntled employees of major world museums who would desecrate these priceless artworks, occasionally some lunatic off the street. I mean, you know, they would borrow their children's crayons and, you know, assault a Madonna or whatever, you know, and just scribble and, you know, do something to it. And it's like all those things, they come and go. But for a while, it was a real problem, not just in this country, but in Italy, too. And this is really, I mean, the title, this explains the title, but not so much the poem, which is about something else. a different kind of Madonna is desecrated in the poem. It's called Madonna's Touched Up with Goatees. Most ancient metaphysics, poor metaphysics, all decked out in imitation jewelry. We went for a stroll arm in arm, smooching in public despite the difference in ages. It's still the 19th century, she whispered. We were in a knife-fighting neighborhood among some run-down relics of the Industrial Revolution. Just a little farther, she assured me, in the back of a certain candy store only she knew about, the customers were engrossed in the phenomenology of the spirit. It's long past midnight, my dove, my angel. We'd better be careful, I thought. There were young hoods on street corners with crosses and iron studs on their leather jackets. They all looked like their Red Darwin and that madman Pavlov, and were about to ask us for a light. In late 80s, I began to sort of remember myself, that period in 1958 when I left Chicago. It was summer of 1958, and I went to New York, basically moved to New York, although all my friends said, you know, what do you want to go to New York for? But they had a point because I had a good job and friends in Chicago, but I just didn't, you know, I didn't think of this. I didn't have a job and I didn't have any friends in New York. So the first few months I was very, very lonely and, you know, full of self-pity and which is delicious when you're young, you know. And I, you know, I couldn't go back to Chicago because they would have said, you know, I told you so. And so I stayed, and I'll just read a couple of poems from this period, actually written, as I say, much, much, much later. You know, it was later. It was a point where when I wrote him. I mean, I could see myself from a great distance, and almost as a character in a book, and so it was delicious to, you know, to look at myself. And this is called Shelley, I mean, the little money that, you know, I used to have, I mean, I would go and to these used bookstores and, you know, buy something and cheap. I mean, it wasn't what I wanted, but what was readable and I could afford. And I purchased a volume of Shelley's poetry. I think I read Shelley before, but that particular night, evening that I described, I thought he was the greatest poet who ever lived. And so the lines of Shelley's in the poem, which are just thrown in as I remember them, Shelley, fall 1958. Poet of the dead leaves, driven like ghosts, driven like pestilence-stricken multitudes, I read you first one rainy evening in New York City, in my atrocious Slavic accent, saying the mellifluous verses from a battered, much-stained volume I had bought earlier that day in a second-hand bookstore on 4th Avenue, run by initiate of the occult masters. The little money I had being almost spent, I walked the streets, my nose in the book. I sat in a dingy coffee shop with last summer's dead flies on the table. The owner was an ex-sailor who had grown a huge hump on his back while watching the rain, the empty street. He was glad to have me sit and read. He'd refill my cup with a liquid dark as river Styx. Shelley spoke of a mad, blind, dying king, of rulers who neither see nor feel nor know, of graves from which a glorious phantom may burst to illumine our tempestuous day. I too felt like a glorious phantom going to have my dinner in a Chinese restaurant I knew so well. It had a three-fingered waiter who'd bring my soup and rice each night without ever saying a word. I never saw anyone else there. The kitchen was separated by a curtain of glass beads which clicked faintly whenever the front door opened. The front door opened that evening to admit a pale little girl with glasses. The poet spoke of the everlasting universe of things, of gleams of a remoter world which visit the soul in sleep, of a desert peopled by storms alone. The streets were strewn with broken umbrellas which looked like funereal kites this little Chinese girl might have made. The bars of MacDougal Street were emptying. There had been a fist fight. A man leaned against a lamppost, arms extended as if crucified, the rain washing the blood off his face. In a dimly lit side street where the sidewalk shone like a ballroom mirror at closing time, a well-dressed man without any shoes asked me for money. His eyes shone. He looked triumphant, like a fencing master who had just struck a mortal blow. How strange it all was, the world's raffle, that dark October night. The yellowed volume of poetry with its splendors and glooms, which I studied by the light of storefronts, drugstores, and barbershops, afraid of my small windowless room, cold as a tomb of an infant emperor. Today, we went for lunch to, I guess, in West Washington and out there and some distance away. And, I mean, when I was there, you know, when I was here, I should say, well, you know, little factories, sweatshops, and a totally different kind of look. This is called Factory, this next poem, but this is New York City, what is now called Soho. Was likewise a place of mysterious businesses and small manufacturers, you know, trucks parked out on the street, and then, you know, nobody much around in the at night, and I don't know what the hell they made. Then all of a sudden, you know, this was I guess early 60s, late 1950s. They all, well, went bankrupt, and people began to kind of move into these spaces. And so the poem, Factory. The machines were gone, and so were those who worked them. A single high-backed chair stood like a throne in all that empty space. I was on the floor making myself comfortable for a long night of little sleep and much thinking. An empty birdcage hung from a steam pipe. In it, I kept an apple and a small paring knife. I placed newspapers all around me on the floor so I could jump at the slightest rustle. It was like the scratching of a pen, the silence of the night writing in its diary. Of rats who came to pay me a visit, I had the highest opinion. They'd stand on 2 feet as if about to make a polite request on a matter of great importance. Many other strange things came to pass. Once a naked woman climbed on the chair to reach the apple in the cage. I was on the floor watching her go on tiptoe, her hand fluttering in the cage like a bird. Another day, the sun peeked through dusty window panes to see what time it was. But there was no clock, only the knife in the cage, glinting like a mirror, and the chair in the far corner where someone once sat facing the brick wall. Now something very different. A little poem called Transport, which is a strange word that Emily Dickinson liked. She was transported, a kind of ecstasy, and lots of ways in which she used it, but she liked that word, transport. In the frying pan on the stove, I found my love and me naked. Chopped onions fell on our heads and made us cry. It's like a parade, I told her, confetti when some guy reaches the moon. Means of transport, she replied obscurely, while we fried. Means of transport. This is a poem. I have to do a little explanation here. It sounds like it's a 19th century poem. It's called The Clocks of the Dead. And, I have no idea, but at some point, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, clocks, watches stopped ticking. I mean, batteries now, they have all this stuff. Before, you'd say, what time is it? And somebody's, looks at their wristwatch and then they put it against the ear to make sure it's working, it's ticking. And, at some point all the timepieces became silent. And when I wrote this poem, I didn't realize that this was going to happen. So now this needs this footnote, so to speak. It's a New York City poem, The Clocks of the Dead. One night I went to keep the clock company. It had a loud tick after midnight as if it were uncommonly afraid. It's like whistling past a graveyard, I explained. In any case, I told him I understood. Once there were clocks like that in every kitchen in America. Now the factory's windows are all broken. The old men on night shift are in Caron's boat. The day you stop, I said to the clock, the little wheels they keep in reserve will have rolled away into many hard-to-find places. Just thinking about it, I forgot to wind the clock. We woke up in the dark. How quiet the city is, I said. Like the clocks of the dead, my wife replied. Grandmother on the wall, I hear the snows of your childhood begin to fall. I think I'll read from this new book. I'll go back to some older stuff, but just now for a moment. It's called Jack Straw's because I see it's for sale. There are a lot of insects in this book, and some of my dear friends were really worried. They said, you know, is he drinking too much? What are all these bugs he's seeing? And it's just that I always had tremendous interest in, you know, critters. I mean, little things that kind of, nameless little things that crawl by you or occasionally, and I live in the country, so, you know, plenty of these sort of nameless little things that are around. And even in the city, I mean, you know, in the city where you can't see a cow, a rat, you know, there was a poem about a rat, but I mean, a fly or some other insect is, you know, kind of interesting. And they always seem very busy. They always have important things to do, errands, and, you know. Then they get confused, you know, they kind of say, wait a minute, I forgot this, and they're going to go back, you know. Ants, you know, ants are scatterbrained, you know. So I mean, you know, I just thought, well, you know, let me throw a lot of insects in. And this poem is called "The Soul Has Many Brides." In India, I was greatly taken up with a fly in a temple, which gave me the distinct feeling it was possible, just possible, that we had met before. Was it in Mexico City, climbing the blood-spotted yellow legs of the crucified Christ while his eyes grew larger and larger? May God seat you on the highest throne of his invisible kingdom, a blind beggar said to me in English. He knew what I saw. At the saloon where Pancho Villa fired his revolvers at the ceiling, on the bare ass of a naked nymph stepping out of a lake in a painting, and now shamelessly crawling up one of Buddha's nostrils, whose smile got even more secretive, even more squint-eyed. Well, this is different. I mean, and older, not terribly older, but it's hard to remember when one wrote these things. Like this poem, I mean, if somebody pointed a gun in my temple, I wouldn't know. I would say 15 years ago. All right. This is called "Ghosts." It's Mr. Brown looking much better than he did in the morgue. He's brought me a huge carp in a blood-stained newspaper. What an odd visit. I haven't thought of him in years. Linda is with him, and so is Sue, two pale and elegant fading memories holding each other by the hand. Even their lipstick is fresh, despite all the scientific proofs to the contrary. Is Linda going to cook the fish? She turns and gazes in the direction of the kitchen, while Sue continues to watch me mournfully. I don't believe any of it, and still I'm scared stiff. I know of no way to respond, so I do nothing. The windows are open. The air is thick with a scent of magnolias. Drops of evening rain are dripping from the dark and heavy leaves. I take a deep breath. I close my eyes. Dear specters, I don't even believe you are here. So how is it you're making me comprehend things I would rather not know just yet? It's the way you stare past me and what must already be my own ghost before taking your leave as unexpectedly as you came in without one of us breaking the silence. This next poem is a kind of a midsummer New England poem, and I have a number of those. you know, people get together and it's wonderful. It's beautiful day and friends get together. And West started as a joyous occasion for some reasons that are very complicated usually. The mood changes, it turns sour, or something happens, there's a quarrel, or not an overt quarrel, but, you know, all kinds of little subtle things are happening. So, you know, an attempt to kind of evoke that moment when, you know, everything seems right with the world. It's just a beautiful day and beautiful afternoon, beautiful evening, and then this note that, you know, enters. And not so much spoiling it, making it more interesting. At the cookout, the wives of my friends have the air of having shared a secret. Their eyes are lowered, but when we ask them what for, they only glance at each other and smile, which only increases our desire to know. Something they did long ago, heedless of the consequences, that left such a lingering sweetness. Is that the explanation for the way they rest their chins in the palms of their hands, their eyes closed in the summer heat? Come, tell us, or give us a hint. Trace a word or just a single letter in the wine spilled on the table. No reply. Both of them lovey-dovey with the waning sunlight and the evening breeze on their faces. The husbands drinking and saying nothing, dazed and mystified as they are by their wife's power to give and take away happiness as if their heads were crawling with snakes. Okay, let's see. It's a poem. It's a library poem. I do have also a number of library poems, and this one is about reading history in the library. Reading history is always a very ancient history or contemporary history. It's always a very strange experience. Forget about the library. Let's say you're in bed you're reading about 4th century China or India, you know, and some great massacre, some huge slaughter. And you know how history loves to round off the numbers. It's always like 100,000, 200,000, you know, king, so on and so, beheaded with his right arm, you know, 5,000 enemy, you know, lords or whatever they were, generals. And you kind of suspect all the, you know all the horror that went beyond these sort of rounded off numbers, and you're perfectly comfortable in bed. You know, you got a big cat, you know, and your tummy purring, you know, life is great. You're squinting there, you know, reading about horror that happened to, you know, all sorts of innocent people. So, I mean, library is equally, you know, awful place to be doing this. So, anyway, the poem, Reading History. At times reading here in the library, I'm given a glimpse of those condemned to death centuries ago and of their executioners. I see each pale face before me the way a judge pronouncing a sentence would, marveling at the thought that I do not exist yet. With eyes closed, I can hear the evening birds. Soon they will be quiet, and the final night on earth will commence in the fullness of its sorrow. How vast, dark, and impenetrable are the early morning skies of those led to their death in a world from which I am entirely absent, where I can still watch someone slump back, someone who is walking away from me with his hands tied, his graying head still on his shoulders, someone who, in what little remains of his life, knows in some vague way about me and thinks of me as God, as the devil. Another New York City poem. Don't you have a lot of New York City poems? This is called The One to Worry About. I failed miserably at imagining nothing. Something always came to keep me company. A small nameless bug crossing the table. The memory of my mother, the ringing in my ear. I was distracted and perplexed. A hole is invariably a hole in something. About 7 this morning, a lone beggar waited for me with his small, sickly dog, whose eyes grew bigger on seeing me. "There goes," the eye said, "that nice man to whom appearances to the contrary, nothing in this whole wide world is sacred." I was still a trifle upset entering the bakery when an unknown woman stepped out of the back to wait on me, dressed for a night on the town in a low-cut, tight-fitting black dress. Her face was solemn, her eyes averted, while she placed a muffin in my hand, as if all along she knew what I was thinking. Some of my most important reading that I do in my life is when I have my car serviced, repaired in Rochester, New Hampshire. There's a library of sort of odd publications, magazines of having to do with hunting and guns and cars and, you know, other things of that sort. And a couple of years ago, I saw, you're so bored. I mean, you know, this real slate, you know, what you're supposed to do, and you start reading classified ads and the little ads. And I saw just a little thing which the ad started. It said past life's therapy. This is people who, you know, you were Robespierre, you know, in your previous life, you know, or, and you're having indigestion today, you know, you have to take a lot of Tums because all those guillotined aristocrats or whatever, you know. God knows. I mean, I didn't go. I was just short. I mean, you know, it was. But it gave me an idea. You know, this is a subject, clearly. You know, maybe there are some therapists, past life therapists, in the crowd. But I mean, it's tough enough with this life. You know, you got to worry about 17 other lives. And of course, the joke is always, you know, it's like you're never a peasant someplace. You know. Digging a ditch, he always, you know, the queen of something, you know, who was not loved by her husband and, you know, so forth. Marie Antoinette, you know, all those jokes about Marie Antoinette. All right, past life's therapy. They explained to me the bloody bandages on the floor in the maternity ward in Rochester, New York. Cured the backache I acquired bowing to my old master, made me stop putting thumbtacks around my bed. They showed me an officer on horseback waving a saber next to a burning farmhouse and a barefoot woman in a nightgown throwing stones after him and calling him Lucifer. I was a straw-headed boy in patched overalls. Come dark, a chicken would roost in my hair. Some even laid eggs as I played my ukulele, and my mother and father crossed themselves. Next, I saw myself inside an abandoned gas station, constructing a spaceship out of a coffin, red traffic cone, cement mixer, and ear warmers, when a church lady fainted seeing me in my underwear. Some days, however, they opened door after door, always to a different room, and could not find me. There'd be only a small squeak now and then, as if a miner's canary got caught in a mousetrap. Just a few more poems. This is called Summer in the Country. One shows me how to lie down in a field of clover, another how to slip my hand under her Sunday skirt, another how to kiss with a mouth full of blackberries, another how to catch fireflies in a jar after dark. Here is a stable with a single black mare and the proof of God's existence riding in a red nightgown. Devil's child, or whatever else she was, having the nerve to ask me to go get her a whip. This is called Views from a Train, and it actually happens in Mexico. Views from a Train. Then there is the aesthetic paradox, which notes that someone else's tragedy often strikes the casual viewer with the feeling of happiness. There was the sight of squatters' shacks, naked children and lean dogs running on what looked like a town dump, the smallest one hopping after them on crutches. All of a sudden, we were in a tunnel. The wheels ground our thoughts back and forth as if they were gravel. Before long, we found ourselves on a beach, the water blue, the sky cloudless, seaside villas, palm trees, white sand. A woman in a red bikini waved to us as if she knew each one of us individually and was sorry to see us heading so quickly into another tunnel. A poem called Unmade Beds. And both unmade beds and you know, perfectly made beds are very interesting objects or subjects. The great photographs of unmade beds and the great photographs of, you know, perfectly made beds in, you know, in rooms where there's no one else. And so this is the unmade beds. Unmade beds. They're like shady rooms, peeling wallpaper, cracks on the ceiling, flies on the pillow. If you're tempted to lie down, don't be surprised. You won't mind the dirty sheets, the rasp of rusty springs as you make yourself comfy. The room is a darkened movie theater where a grainy black and white film is being shown. A blur of disrobed bodies in the moment of sweet indolence that follows lovemaking, when the meanest of hearts comes to believe happiness can last forever. And I think I'll end with a poem from Jack Straus. And this is really an old, old memory. I have no idea how old I was, but I was very young. I mean, 5, 6. Absolutely no notion of how. What I remember about it is that this was the first time I realized the possibility of sort of becoming a felon, crime, the life of how the pleasures of stealing and so two roads, it's called A Toy, and it has 5 parts. I mean, I just make a little, small little parts. I make a tiny pause between them. The brightly painted horse had a boy's face and 4 small wheels under his feet, plus a long string to pull him this way and that across the floor should you care to. A string in waiting that slipped away with many wiles from each and every step. Knock, and they'll answer, my mother told me, so I climbed the 4 flights and went in unannounced and found a small toy horse for the taking. In the ensuing emptiness and the fading daylight that still gives me a shudder as if I held in my hand the key to mysteries. What is the lost and found and the quiet entry, the undeveloped film of the few clear moments of our blurred lives? What is the drop of blood and the tiny nail that pricked my finger as I bent down to touch the toy and caught its eye? Wintry light. My memories are steep stairwells in dusty buildings on dead-end streets where I talk to the walls and close doors as if they understood me. The wooden toy sitting pretty. No, quieter than that. Like the sound of eyebrows raised by a villain in a silent movie. Psst, someone said behind my back. Thank you.